Kansas City's first female fire chief has taken charge of the fire department here in town. That's the first female fire chief in the department's more than 150-year history. It's a big deal as a first for the city. But the woman taking the job is far from new to the Kansas City Fire Department. Donna Mays has been hanging out in fire stations her whole life. Her dad was a firefighter here, too. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And on today's show, we're going to get to know Fire Chief Donna Mays. Hi, Donna. Thanks so much for being here.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
How does it feel to not only be taking on this huge role, but to be the first woman ever to do it in the history of an organization that's been around for more than a century?
Oh, my. It is, for me, it's a lifelong dream that I've had. You know, when I first started my career with the fire department pretty early on, I decided that I was going to go as far as I could within the organization. And
leadership was always a goal.
Yes, always a goal.
Talk to me about that.
So, you know, I think it was just kind of the example that my parents had always set for me like you said, growing up in the fire stations and getting to see and meet first responders and hear the stories from my dad and all of that. It was really about, you know, how do I provide that kind of, you know, really that public service and really the, you know, it was about helping other people and hearing things and doing things and activities with my dad that were kind of outside of, you know, when he would see some social service needs. You know, I remember him organizing a cleanup of a person's house that, you know, really had no other opportunities or no other people that could come help that person. And he brought us as children with him to help do that. And my mom and
had the house been on fire, or this was just someone who needed help cleaning?
No, it was a house that the person, his only heat source was a wood burning stove that was vented inside of his house. So, I mean, they would get calls on it for smoke coming from the eaves, but the house wouldn't be on fire. And of course, nobody can, you know, really live in those conditions without having that external ventilation of their wood burning furnace. And just really, he was an older man, an elderly man that really needed that, you know, help. And so, you know, like I said, he kind of organized that. And I think that was probably when I was about 14. And
that must have made a huge impression on you. You remember the details of exactly like the ventilation situation and.
Right. It was. It was a huge impression. And I think that's really kind of seeing how you could help people and really affect somebody's life is kind of what drew me to following in his footsteps to join the fire department.
What does a fire chief do exactly? I know that might sound silly, but I just imagine being like, I'm in charge. You
know? Right. Well, there is a little bit of that. But really, it's about, my leadership style and what I've been talking to the responders about, you know, when I've gone out to all the stations and done station visits and visited, you know, people at different work sites is, you know, as you reach these higher levels within the fire department, it's really an internal focus to ensure that the people that have the day-to-day contact and interaction with, you know, with our residents here in Kansas City have the tools and equipment and training that they need to be able to, you know, provide that service no matter what the call is. And so for me, it's, you know, my job is to really, you know, work with City Hall and with the finance department and all of the other departments that we work with and interact with to ensure that we have, you know, the right budgetary numbers and that we are able to really ensure that we're following all the safety practices that, you know, nationally are set by, by national organizations like, you know, National Fire Protection Association.
It seems, can I jump in and say, it seems like there would be a lot of anticipating the unexpected because the calls that you get are not, you know, you can't like make projections necessarily, can you?
Well, we kind of go back based on our history. And so we look at our historical data, you know, what our call volume was the previous year and the years before that and the types of calls. And so we kind of use that to project forward of, you know, what we expect and just looking at, you know, the different societal issues and needs that are coming, you know, coming up. We try to, you know, anticipate those and work towards, you know, making sure that we have the equipment and tools to handle those types of calls or whatever is thrown at us.
What kind of societal needs cross paths with the work of the fire department?
So I think it's a lot about healthcare and health needs for the fire service. It's really morphing into kind of a social service and emergency medical service organization. And so you see a lot, you know, we in Kansas City, unfortunately, we do have a certain amount of a homeless population and kind of that those transient people that really, you know, don't have other resources, or they don't have their, you know, there's a lot of people that live without health care. And so when they really have a medical need or a medical issue, the first number they, you know, we've done a really good job of telling people, call 911 when you need help. And so that's, those are the kind of needs that we are strive to meet.
So we talked a little bit about the role of a fire chief, mm-hmm. which is the role you are taking on. There is, other than the actual activities that you'll be mm-hmm. performing in this role, there's a symbolic component to the job, as there is with any leadership role. Mm-hmm. Who an organization puts in charge sets a certain tone and also makes a statement about the values and identity of the organization. Like, this is who we are. Mm-hmm. What do you think your appointment means symbolically?
So symbolically, you know, for me as a firefighter, and like I said, you know, with my history and my past, it's always about public service and just setting that tone that, you know, our responders are there to meet the needs and provide that service to the citizens. But for me, as being the first female in this role, it's really symbolic in the sense that it really shows people in the, you know, citizens and young women and girls that, you know, you can be a leader and you can achieve your goals and you can really, if you work hard enough at anything, you can be successful.
And it, if you don't mind my saying mm-hmm. so, you can perform demanding, physically demanding jobs that are physically dangerous because you've risen up in the ranks starting as a firefighter yourself.
Yeah. Yes, correct. And so, you know, it's just, it's really, it's a non-traditional role that a lot of people don't, a lot of women don't see as a path for them, you know, when they're going through high school and that sort of thing. And we do some, you know, recruitment and we, you know, really try to get our message out there about, you know, this is an organization that is welcoming of all people, you know, whether it's, you know, based on race, ethnicity, you know, male, female, gender, whatever it is, you know, we really want to have a workforce that reflects the community because it's really important, you know, when we go into the community that people see these responders and people of authority that, you know, look like them and can relate to them in certain ways.
You've been in the fire department since 1992. What was it like to be a woman joining the department as a firefighter back then?
So at that point in time, we had about 34, 35 females out of about 980 responders. And so, very limited number of females. And so it was, you know, challenging in the sense that, you know, there weren't other people that I could really relate to. And you know, when you're spread across a city as large as ours and on three different shifts, you're not working all the time with those other females and really getting to build that camaraderie and, you know, share those experiences that are unique to, you know, women in a non-traditional role. So that makes it a little difficult.
An example of one of those unique situations.
So, you know, I think, you know, everybody worries about, you know, women and their strength in the fire service and, you know, whether you're relying on, you know, a lot of people want to just bully their way through things and use all of their upper body strength. And, you know, I think that women have to learn to adjust and adapt like we do on a day-to-day basis, but, you know, using, you know, your full body and using the core of your body and your legs and your thighs, which are stronger muscle groups, to help you, you know, adjust and use a different technique to whether it's pulling hose or climbing a ladder or whatever it is. So,
and so then just not having someone to talk to about how you're approaching it versus how the rest of the people around you are approaching it.
Well, that, and then just having that commonality of, you know, ensuring that you really feel like somebody can understand where you're coming from. And, you know, when you're on a call, I think people respond to calls differently. And, you know, if calls with, you know, fatalities or children or, you know, any of those types of calls where you really see some injured people, it's, you know, everybody responds differently. And I think, you know, kind of females may have more of a motherly instinct and kind of a protective instinct where they might respond differently than males. And, you know, you don't talk about it the same way with your coworkers. So
what you've talked a little bit about what made you want to be a firefighter, and you've mentioned seeing your dad and his approach to being a firefighter and mm-hmm. feeling really inspired by that. But ultimately, you must have had your own reasons.
Yeah, I think, you know, I was getting ready to graduate. You know, my undergraduate is from, you know, University of Central Missouri, and I was getting close to graduating, and my undergrad was in public relations. And, you know, I just was really struggling with, could I go do the typical 9-to-5 corporate world. And I hear you. it really worked out timing wise that they were getting ready to go through a process to hire a class of firefighters and put a list together. And so I started in that process before I graduated from college. And it kind of became that crunch time of, okay, what direction am I going to go? And I was like, you know what, this is what I know. This is what I've seen. This is what I, you know, have grown up with and learned to love. And so that's kind of why I went that direction. And it's really such a unique opportunity to do and sample and try so many different things all in one career path. So
have you ever had a moment where you found yourself kind of fantasizing about the path not taken? Like, what would that sort of desk job have looked like?
Not really, because I've had that opportunity as well, you know, as I've risen through the ranks, you know, being an assistant fire chief over, you know, technical services or the special operations deputy chief, you know, even the role I'm in now is more of that traditional 9-to-5 kind of role. And so it's really good that I've had, you know, the field experience and the, you know, kind of the experience in various areas of the fire service that really helped prepare me for this role of taking on the leadership of the organization.
I want to go back to your childhood experience of fire departments and fire stations. Kids love, in my experience, all things relating to fire stations and fire trucks. I feel pretty comfortable, in fact, like making that generalization, just like kids love it. But growing up with a dad who was a firefighter must have given you special perspective on the work and also the culture that exists in fire stations.
Yeah, I think it did. You know, a lot of parents try to protect and shelter their children from, you know, whatever type of work they do. And, you know, my dad was very open about that and shared all of those experiences. You know, I know there were nights that, you know, he had gone to the hospital because his ears had been burned or whatever. And, you know, the worry my mom saw and or felt and, you know, really not knowing, you know, what the extent of injuries were, those sorts of things. Or, you know, when he's had risked his life, you know, to pull a woman and her two children out of the Blue River after they'd fallen through the ice on it.
You know, that must have been so scary for you as a kid.
You know, I think probably it was, but, you know, a little bit surreal in the sense that, you know, I didn't actually witness it versus him coming home and knowing he was okay. You know, we got to see him after he was, you know, okay, so.
But still just knowing that there was that risk in the work that he was out doing.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I think that's one of the biggest things he's ever instilled in me and my two sisters and my brother is the fact that even with that risk, you have to be able to have the confidence in yourself and your own ability and know that you can get through just about anything. And I mean, obviously there's circumstances, you know, there is a lot of tragedy and death in the fire service, but just, you know, he always instilled that confidence that, you know, we could do whatever we set our minds to. And he showed it over and over again to us in everything he did. So
is that something you've thought about differently as a firefighter yourself and now as a boss of firefighters, the one who's sending personnel into potentially harm's way and sort of equipping them to do that?
Yeah. You know, I think there's a sense of responsibility to make sure that they are equipped, you know, to do their jobs. And you've got to have enough confidence and trust in, you know, the fact that they've got a wealth of experience and training. But yeah, there's still that protective side. You know, I don't want to be responsible for somebody, you know, losing their life potentially. I mean, that's something that, you know, we're still recovering from the loss of life, you know, that we had 4 years ago. And so that's really been
remind us, I know it's painful, but remind us of that situation.
So we had two firefighters that passed away after a wall collapsed on them at a fire in 2015. So, and yeah, that's been, in some regards, it's been kind of that renewed sense of, you know, awareness and training and really, you know, working together and knowing your crews that you're working with and respecting when the leadership sets a collapse zone or sets a parameter or whatever they do, really following those directions. And the other piece of it has been really this renewed sense of camaraderie and growth within the organization. You know, we're realizing more and more how those types of events affect everybody within the organization because everybody deals with tragedy differently. And so really it's about looking at how do we support people that are still recovering from the emotional effects of an event like that.
You know, you've talked about that you started your career with the fire department wanting to advance as high as possible. And mm-hmm. I think it's safe to say you are now, you have achieved that goal of advancing as far as possible. Mm-hmm. So it seems silly to ask you what made you want the job of fire chief when it opened up. But I still do want to know, beyond just advancing as far as possible, mm-hmm. moving into as high of a leadership role as you could, why?
You know, I think that I've always positioned myself in ways that I've been able to learn about, you know, whether I was an instructor at our fire academy or whether I was driving a battalion chief or a captain on a crew. It was really, you know, I've got ideals and really love the organization in the sense that, you know, reinstilling pride and professionalism in the fire service, and especially in Kansas City Fire Department. Not that there isn't pride and professionalism, but really being able to put those values and instill, you know, my thoughts on that, you know, within the organization has been something that really is another reason that I wanted to do this. So,
how common is it for fire departments to have female fire chiefs?
You know, I haven't researched the latest statistics, but about 3 or 4 years ago, I did a paper on that topic in my MPA program. And so about at that time, there was about 3% of all of the professional fire departments versus the volunteer fire departments, about 3% had female fire chiefs. And of that, of the more, you know, large, you know, more than 100,000 resident, you know, fire departments that served residents of cities of the size of 100,000, it dropped down to about 1%. So it's a very small number. It's growing. You know, and in the last 4 or 5 years in the International Association of Fire Chiefs, there's more and more women that are showing up and taking on those leadership roles within fire departments. And so you're starting to see more and more women at those conferences and events. And so
you have 2 daughters, and I wonder what mm-hmm. you hope they kind of file away about this moment of their mom becoming the first woman to serve as fire chief in Kansas City.
I think, you know, I've always tried to kind of instill those same values in them, that whatever area of focus, whatever their dreams are and whatever their career path is, that they do it the best they can. They give it their all. And, you know, I've always tried to do things to, you know, my biggest judge of how I'm doing is how proud of me that they are. And so that's kind of what I look for is with them. I really want them to know that, you know, put your best effort forward in anything you choose to do.
Donna Mays, congratulations on the job.
Thank you.
I'm Gina Kaufman. That was the new fire chief in town, Donna Mays, the first woman to hold that position in the 150-year history of the Kansas City Fire Department. If you didn't catch the whole interview, it'll be at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. Up next, a little check-in with the editor of the Shawnee Mission Post about what's going on in his community. Stay tuned. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And my next guest is Jay Center. He's the editor of the Shawnee Mission Post. And his business model was recently covered by the Nieman Lab at Harvard, where they studied journalism in America. So it seems like what they are doing at this online community news outlet is kind of a big deal. And that's because in an era where a lot of metro-wide newspapers can't stay afloat, can't get people to subscribe, the Shawnee Mission Post is actually thriving with a paywall. Jay Center, good morning.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. We have talked about your paywall a little bit before, but could you give a quick recap of the decision you made to charge for content, why you did it, and what that allowed you to do in your coverage?
Yeah, absolutely. The Shawnee Mission Post started back in June of 2010. It was called the Prairie Village Post back then. And we started out, we were covering just Prairie Village, Fairway, Mission Hills. And we had the same model that was pretty prevalent at the time, which was everything was accessible to everybody and everything was free. And the way we made our money was through online ads. And, you know, there was enough interest in local coverage. There had been a pretty notable vacuum of coverage of city government, school board, things like that in the area for the years preceding the launch of the site. There's enough interest in what we were doing that we were getting traffic figures that allowed us to go to local businesses and kind of Johnson County-wide businesses and say, hey, if you want to reach this audience, buy an ad. That allowed our business to grow, you know, over the course of 4 years. In 2014, I was able to quit doing my day job and move to the Shawnee Mission Post full time. But my co-founder, Dan Blum, and I kind of got to the point around 2015, 2016, where we said, you know, the ceiling on what we're going to be able to generate in revenue from online ads only really is not going to be sustainable. You know, the two of us are sort of barely able to pay ourselves enough to justify it and make ends meet. We were working a lot. We really had no kind of backup plan. There was no cushion in the model. And so by the time we got to 2017, we had basically tried everything we could think of to have a free access, open to everybody model, and just had run out of ideas. And, you know, frankly, we were...
So this was a, we do this or we stop.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. We were down to, I was our only full-time employee at that point. Basically, when we announced it to our readers, said, listen, we told our readers in February of 2017, starting in April, you're going to have to pay a subscription fee if you want full access to everything. We promise you we will stay in business through November to cover the school board elections, but you know, after that, we can't really make any promises. So at that point, basically, we mapped it out and figured that, okay, if we get to 1,000 subscribers in a calendar year, so by April of 2018, if we get to 1,000 subscribers, we will have generated enough revenue that this will make sense and we can keep doing it. And, you know, we won't have a ton of resources, but we should be able to, like, probably...
You're going to tread water.
We're going to... Yeah, well, we would be able to keep going. And I was very... skeptical, frankly, that it was going to work. I mean, I on my optimistic.
I'm guessing you were making some plan Bs.
Oh my gosh, we had called our realtor. We were ready to we were preparing to make a move because we just could not. It was my optimistic days. I thought we probably had a 50% chance of success. So, to my immense surprise and gratitude, we got to 1,000 subscribers in 3.5 months. So at that point, we realized, okay, wait, like the community values this enough that we've got people who are willing to support us. And that totally, basically completely reframed where the business was.
Well, yeah. So when the paywall is actually something that ended up not just allowing you to stay afloat, it ended up helping you shift the focus of your coverage.
Yeah, 100%. So, and this is like... not a conscious move that we had made over the years, but when you're an online, or when you're ad only supported, right? Your incentive is to just generate as many page views as humanly possible, because every time a new page loads, you serve an ad, and you can tell your advertisers, "Hey, I'm showing this to this many people." So if that's the only way you're making money, your incentive, consciously or subconsciously, is to just generate traffic. Whether you are generating that traffic by producing content that actually has value and meaning to people, or whether you're generating traffic because it's sort of sensational and like silly or scandalous or whatever. And so every minor fire, every minor car wreck, you know, the example I always use is there was a day that a car in Roland Park drove into some wet cement. And so you had we had a photo of a car sort of like trapped in cement.
How can you not click on that?
Exactly. And, you know, tens of thousands of page views for that. But it changes people's lives in no way. It doesn't like tell them anything important about their community, right? So after our coverage mix was, I would say, maybe more like 30% civics 101 accountability kind of journalism and 60% sort of fluffy filler stuff that, generated clicks, but really didn't have a whole lot of value to people. After the paywall went live, what we found was days that our coverage mix was really leaning more towards the less valuable stuff, traffic would be high, but we wouldn't get any new subscribers. Days where our coverage mix was more focused on, hey, here's the city. What the city council is thinking about doing with property taxes next year, or the plans we have for a new community center, they might not have gotten as many clicks. They didn't get as much traffic, but we would see 4, 5, 6, 7 new subscribers convert. And so all of a sudden,
because that was meaningful enough that people were willing to make a long-term commitment to it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so our incentives completely shifted. All of a sudden we had a direct financial relationship with our readers. We had an obligation to give them the kinds of coverage that they valued. And what we found was they valued the kind of like accountability, city council, school board sort of coverage. And so our coverage mix really shifted more to that, to where now it's more like 70% of that stuff, 30% of the other stuff.
So the big news now is that you have so much support in the form of subscriptions that you are actually planning to cut back on advertising next year.
Yes,
which
correct.
Nobody plans to cut back on revenue from advertising.
No, you don't.
Like, I'm planning on making less on advertising at my publication.
Well, you know, in terms of actual revenue, we don't expect like a huge decrease. But basically what we wanted to do was like for people who are paying us for the privilege of going on the site and getting full access to everything we do, we want to make that user experience as good as possible. And again, if your only way to make money is through ads, you try to put as many ads on the site as possible because you want to maximize that revenue stream. That's not necessarily great for advertisers because if you have a ton of ads on the page, there's competition for your attention. Which one of these ads am I actually going to lay my eyes on?
And it's not great for viewers.
It's not great for viewers at all. Like it's a very cluttered experience and sort of like stressful, right? So,
and you start wanting to buy things you never even dreamed
exactly.
about.
But so basically we said, listen, what if we recalibrated our ads so that there are fewer that show up on the page. The ones that do show up on the page are very prominent. Like, so if you're an advertiser, you're going to be happy because there's only one, you're the only person being advertised on the page. So you're going to have that, you know, opportunity to make your impression. And for readers, it's going to be a much less cluttered environment. So we kind of sold fewer ad slots, raise the prices on those bigger ad slots, but it should be, we think, kind of a win-win for advertisers and users.
So when you look back on the paywall that you are able to see how that ended up shifting the focus of your content as a result of this changing business model. So then looking ahead to this next shift, do you see another content shift potentially accompanying that one as well?
I think the way I would respond to that is, so the growth in subscribers has provided revenue a entirely new bucket of revenue that we just didn't have before. And with that revenue over the course of the past year and a half, we've been able to add staff. So we hired our first full-time reporter in January of this year. Our second full-time reporter will start on January 1st of 2019. And I think we would hope to add an additional staff member in 2020 as well. So when you have additional staff, that gives you the bandwidth to say, okay, we do a pretty good job at sort of doing the balls and strikes. Here's just what happened at your city council meeting kind of coverage. What I'd like to see us do more of is a little bit more in-depth stuff that provides context about this issue came up in this city, this issue came up in this city, and it also came up in this third city. Why is it happening right now? How is it playing out differently across the area? And so I would imagine that in addition to sort of the play-by-play coverage we're already doing, we'll get a little bit more into the in-depth coverage next year as well.
The analysis.
Yeah.
What do you think of as the takeaway for struggling news outlets, of which there are many?
I think the heartening thing about our experience is that there is a strong demand for local news, and that if you present your coverage in a way that thinks of your reader first, people will come out and they'll support you. Unfortunately, a lot of the issues we see with publications facing financial struggles, not being able to make ends meet or having to cut back on staff, you have out-of-town ownership, you have publicly traded companies that have shareholders. Their incentives are not necessarily to the people in the communities they're covering. And I think in the next 5, 6, 7 years, we're going to see a pretty big shift, and that some of the legacy outlets that have been in communities across the country for 100 or 150 years are going to be replaced by smaller operations, more nimble operations, and operations that are primarily funded by subscriptions and not advertising. And that's anomalous in history. Even at sort of the height of the newspaper
era. Anomalous in history.
Yes. I mean, throughout the newspaper era, even when people were paying subscriptions to get a newspaper delivered on their driveway every day, those subscription revenues only made up maybe 25% of their total revenue mix.
For someone who is skeptical that this could work a couple of years ago, like you gave it a 50% chance on a good day, you've really like embraced.
I'm evangelical.
Yeah.
Because the direct financial relationship with your readers, it creates a better situation for everybody, right? I mean, it makes you accountable to the people in the communities you're covering that you just aren't if you are primarily looking to get advertisers. It totally disincentivizes you from, I would say, disrespecting your readers by sensationalizing headlines, things like that. I mean, the number one thing that our readers have said they value about us is that we're just a straightforward, trustworthy source of information. And that means that you don't go out of your way to like blow things up to be bigger than they are. You don't minimize things that are big deals. You just try to take as measured an approach as possible so that people feel like when they read your site, they know what's happening in their community.
So before you go, I do want to talk to you about what's going on in the part of the metro you cover. You are seeing kind of a surprising crossroads in local government. There's a history in Johnson County of elections at the county level being nonpartisan. And you think that may be about to change? Explain.
So, yeah, I think it was the county charter in 1999 established nonpartisan elections. There was a period in Johnson County history where when you went to vote for a city council race in Prairie Village, for example, those city council candidates had a D or an R after their name. You had to register your party affiliation to be on the ballot. So in 1999, with the county charter, the commission at that time said, you know what, we're going to move to nonpartisan races. And the impetus being, listen, for these kinds of decisions about who's picking up trash, what the fees at the pool are going to be for the summer and stuff like that, ideological partisan battles just really don't need to be a part of it. And if we're going to
make sense.
Yeah. And if we're going to have people focusing on just getting the job done, we don't want them to feel like they have to walk any kind of a party line. So that has been in place for the past 20 or almost 30 years now. What has happened over the course of the past 6, 7 years, though, is that you have seen the political parties getting a little bit more and more involved in supporting the candidacies of people running for these nonpartisan races. So maybe 10, 15 years ago, it was very common to see an elephant, you know, the Republican mascot symbol on the sign of somebody running for city council in Overland Park. A way to communicate to people, you know, what their party affiliation was, even though on the ballot, you're not going to see whether they're Democrat or Republican.
Why were political parties actually taking an interest in these elections?
Well, I mean, as with, you know, any organization, when you are you're trying to fill out a bench, you want people who are going to be able to run for bigger things in the future. And so, you know, you start out at city council, you get some experience there, you build some notoriety there, then you can run for the state house, right? And those are obviously partisan elections. So, I mean, it's kind of political parties sort of look at these races in a lot of cases like they're minor leagues. They're trying to fill up a pipeline with people who are going to be capable of running for bigger office down the line. So the big change, though, is that in the past 3 or 4 years, you've seen Johnson County Democrats much more active at the local level and in these nonpartisan races. And be very clear that the Johnson County Republican Party and the Johnson County Democratic Party are not explicitly giving money to individual campaigns, But you've seen both parties use their resources to basically communicate to party members, here are the nonpartisan candidates on the ballot who are registered for our party. And so Johnson County Democrats sent out mailers to people that said, hey, if you're running for, if you're voting in a Lenexa City Council race or the Water Board race, these are the people who are registered Democrats. There are members of the county commission who have been pretty upset about the Democratic circles getting more and more involved in these local elections. Again, both parties have been involved in this kind of behavior for several years.
You're seeing more, though, recently from the Democratic Party?
The Democratic Party, since 2016, has seen more interest, more activity, more resources, and they've been more organized. And that is what you have heard a couple people on the county commission cite as, hey, a line has been crossed. This is, you know, the idea that these are nonpartisan elections is kind of a farce now. And so Mike Brown, who's the county commissioner representing the southwest portion of Johnson County, has said that he is ready to make ending nonpartisan elections part of the county commission discussion in 2021, I believe.
Well, we will have to keep an eye on that. Jay Center, editor of the Shawnee Mission Post, thank you so much and happy Thanksgiving.
You as well. Thanks a lot.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and speaking of Thanksgiving, one of the animals native to this land is the bison. It was nearly hunted out of extinction, but 10 years ago, an effort got underway to bring bison back to Kansas. We'll hear about the herd of bison on the central Kansas prairie in just a minute. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. We are getting ready to talk about bison in Kansas. The National Park Service and Nature Conservancy brought a herd of bison back to the tall grass prairie after an absence of more than a century from that landscape. It has been 10 years since then, and we're hoping to find out how they are doing. My guest in just a moment will be Paula Mateel, joining us from the Tall Grass Prairie National Preserve out in Strong City, Kansas. Though we are having some trouble connecting with Paula, and I am wondering, Paula, are you there? Paula is not there, so I will give you as much backstory as I can while we are waiting for that call. Although, Paula, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Wonderful, Paula. I'm so glad to hear that. I'm very happy. Go ahead and give me the quick backstory, better coming from you, on bison in Kansas, and we'll talk about the herd you've got there now in just a moment. Because Kansas used to be full of bison roaming the prairie, but over time that changed.
That is correct. Way back, before 1870, there was recorded accounts of bison, millions of bison on the Great Plains, from Canada to Texas. And by the turn of the century in 1900, because of, trapping but hunting and sport and even trading use of different parts of the bison numbers just dropped drastically. And around that 1900, we were down to a few animals, so they were almost extirpated. And slowly and gradually, our bison are back on the landscape, and the numbers are up, through government agencies, private landowners, and the Nature Conservancy, an organization that I work for now.
What was the idea 10 years ago behind that move to introduce a herd of bison to the Prairie Preserve in the Flint Hills?
Well, just a little background for your listeners. Tallgrass Prairie National Preserve is a preserve that became a national part of the National Park Service in 1996 to protect the most altered landscape or endangered prairie that, known as the Tallgrass Prairie. So this park is a unique park, and we are about 140 miles.
Paula, I am not hearing you. Are you there? I think we've lost Paula.
Paula. The National Park Service. And the Nature Conservancy, who I work for, we are the primary landowner. And between the two agencies, bringing back the bison to this landscape was a high priority. And yeah, I mean, 10 years ago, this is our 10th year anniversary for having bison. So in 2009, we were challenged with reintroduction of bison. And we were charged with trying to bring in a disease-free herd and genetically pure herd. And the Wind Cave animals at that time, Wind Cave National Park up in South Dakota at that time, met those objectives. So when we, in 2009, we brought 13 animals down from South Dakota and released them into Tallgrass Prairie. And that day, it was just amazing. And since that day, our herd has grown to about 100 animals. And they're thriving. Yeah.
Because I want to just back up. You started with, there were 13 bison on the Tallgrass Prairie National Preserve 10 years ago, and now there are 100.
Right. And we do manage these bison, the Nature Conservancy and the Park Service, and we manage them to have about 75 to 100 head on approximately 1,100 acres. And so to manage these animals, we round them up each fall, and we have to remove a few, and we have sent these bison to other preserves or a zoo. Sedgwick County has received two of those animals. So this herd annually, I'd say approximately we have about 20 babies each spring. And so we, because of our acres out here that we have dedicated to the bison, we want to maintain that 75 to 100 animals.
So for people who have never been to the Tallgrass Prairie Preserve, what's it like there and what is its purpose from the conservationist standpoint? Because I want to get a sense of how the bison fit into that.
Well, the bison are, by nature, I mean, Tallgrass Prairie, Shortgrass Prairie, Mixed Grass Prairie, that is their natural habitat. And the prairie is shaped by grazing and fire in kind of these little disturbances throughout this ecosystem. And the bison, I mean, it is the most natural primary grazer out there. It's the iconic species. And, you know, it's just magnificent to see this big animal standing in tall grass, wide open prairie, doing what it's supposed to do in the best natural setting that we have for them.
So a lot of people have never encountered bison in real life. I have been to the Tallgrass Prairie Preserve and I have seen them. They're huge. There's no overstating that. They're huge.
Yes, they are huge. They can, you know, the bulls can range anywhere from 2,000 pounds and the females around 1,200 pounds. They're big. Yes, even the babies, when they look little, you get close to them, they're pretty big themselves.
What are some other fun facts about bison other than the just sort of insane proportions of them, which I want to say about that? On the prairie preserve, there aren't trees. There aren't really like frames of reference. You can't even tell how close you are to a bison because they're so unfathomably large. But other fun facts, you've gotten to be around them day in and day out.
Well, just watching their behavior is very interesting. You've got your dominant bull, and we try to keep a 50-50 ratio of males to females out here. We're trying to be as natural as we can in the herd demographic area. And so we do have this, you know, some of the bulls are jockeying for, you know, to see who's dominant bull, that kind of thing. And then you've got those are the older adult bulls. And then you've got these 2 and 3 year old boys that, you know, we call them the teenagers. And often you'll see them off from the main herd because they're not not quite in position to, you know, jockey for the dominant bull position. And then you have these herds that that they're actually, the female rules the herd. And when the females decide that they want to move, or they want the herd to move, they're the ones that get up and decide, okay, we're going to move now. So the females really do rule the herd.
So when the female bison starts walking away, everyone just follows her?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. And when it's time to go to another area to graze, yep, they'll follow the female. And also, another couple interesting behavior things that the bison do is wallowing. And it's kind of interesting to watch these big, large animals lay down and wallow.
What is wallowing?
Tiny legs up.
I feel like wallowing. I know what this is in the human sense, but...
Uh-huh. Wallowing is just, you know, getting on their back and itching it in the dirt, you know, trying to scratch their back.
Okay.
Or to get, you know, like in the spring, they'll wallow to get their winter fur off.
Whoa. So this is fun to watch?
Yeah, it is. It is. Again, it's just amazing. The hikers, we have 41 miles of trails out here at the preserve, and hikers, one trail does go through the bison pasture, and most of the people come to tall grass to see the tall grass and to see the bison, and to see the bison in the tall grass prairie setting. And so there's been several weekends where there's a lot of hikers out there watching the bison, and a lot of people taking photos. And so if you haven't seen the bison out in this prairie setting, I think everyone should put it on their bucket list.
So there are rules, though, because the idea of people and bison kind of interacting, that is a little bit, there are dangers in that. You're supposed to stay really far away from them. What are the other rules for, like, being around bison?
Absolutely. I mean, these animals are wild. They are wild animals. They're wildlife.
And I might have mentioned they're huge.
They're huge. And they can also turn on a dime and run 35 miles an hour. And you wouldn't want to be in their way when that happens. What we try to tell our visitors and is safety is very important to us here, is to stay a distance of at least 100 yards. And if you don't know what 100 yards is, it would be like running from one goalpost to the other goalpost on a football field, or think about a track where you have the 100-meter dash, that distance.
Yeah, part of the track. You know, we are almost out of time, but if people come away from this conversation knowing just one thing about the Kansas prairie or the role of bison on the prairie, what do you want that to be?
The role on the prairie is to they are the most natural grazer on the prairie, and how they graze, they keep the tall grass prairie ecosystem healthy.
Well, Paula, thank you so much. Paula Mateel works for the Nature Conservancy at the Tallgrass Prairie National Preserve in Strong City, Kansas. It is a fun day trip if you're looking to get out of the city. That's a wrap. Everything we talked about today will be online at kcur.org/centralstandard in time for the holiday weekend. And we've got lots more material for you there. All of our past shows are available, including yesterday's conversation with Saturday Night Live celeb Holly Gardner back in Kansas City to turn on the plaza lights. kcur.org/centralstandard. Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell, Mackenzie Martin, and Noah Taborda. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. Linda Scher runs the board for us, and our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs. I'm Gina Kaufman.